Welcome to episode 2 of the Language Neuroscience Podcast, a podcast about the scientific study of language and the brain. I'm Stephen Wilson, and I'm a neuroscientist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. This podcast is aimed at an audience of scientists and future scientists who are interested in the neural substrates of language. I'd like to thank the many people who listened to the first episode and have come back to listen again. I'd also like to thank everyone who provided feedback, ideas for topics, and kind words on our first episode. My guest today is a legendary cognitive neuroscientist, Sophie Scott, CBE. That's Commander of the British Empire, for those of you who might not be familiar with the British honours system. Sophie is Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience and Director of the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London. She has done seminal work on the neurobiology of vocal communication, including investigating the functional roles of different streams of auditory processing, exploring homologies with non-human primates, and studying not only speech perception, but also the perception of emotion in the voice, nonverbal vocalizations, and many other topics. Hi, Sophie. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. It's deeply weird in the UK at the moment. We're back into lockdown, so everything's got very small. You know, you're indoors most of the day and gazing at outside and hoping that there's sunshine or a bird you can see or something. It is odd, but no, we're all fine.
So the first thing I'd like to ask you is, how did you become a cognitive neuroscientist who studies language and communication? Like, did you have any interests as a kid that pointed to this future career? Or what's your history there?
When I was a kid, I was very interested in biology, and I liked biology and I enjoyed studying biology. And I started a degree in biology, and I discovered through that, I did a course on animal behaviour, which I thought was incredible. And that made me realize you could study psychology. This is, you know, it wasn't as popular a degree back in the 1980s as it is now. So I changed courses and started a new biology degree, but basically I could take a psychology pathway. Uh-huh. And what I really wanted to do was music. What I liked was music psychology, and that's what I wanted to study. And that's what I sort of did whenever I had a chance at any projects or anything where I got to choose a subject. I would sort of study that. And then I very luckily was accepted onto a PhD place at University College London, where the guy who had accepted me on as PhD supervisor, Peter Howell, had done this work on music that I'd based my third year dissertation on. And I thought That's what I was going to be doing. And then I got to UCL, and his interests really had shifted quite a long time since that paper had been published. And he cared a lot more about speech. So he just moved me sideways onto speech. And I was like,
okay.
And somehow, it's not true. I have kind of got back, but, you know, and I was lucky. I got to study, you know, signal processing and phonetics, and that was kind of actually really useful. So having the biology background and then having this kind of quite fine-grained, detailed learning about speech and sound was very useful in terms of, you know, I've always been more interested in the sound end of kind of communication. And not that I'm more interested in the wider language system, but, you know, that front end is interesting to me. And that came about because of my PhD supervisor's interest. So it meant that when people started doing brain imaging, and around the end time, the end of my PhD, you started to see people talking about PET scans and things like that. But because I had the sort of biology background and then this kind of fairly intense signal level interest in speech, I got involved in some early functional imaging studies, and that was very interesting. It seemed like a very pleasing technique to be able to ask, you know, almost observational questions about the natures of the systems that you're looking at. And that I never really looked back, actually. So I was very fortunate in that a sequence of things I didn't want to happen actually got me completely embedded in an area that I love.
Yeah, that's really great. I guess what a fortuitous time to be right there with that particular training. And yeah, I'd noticed that your dissertation is very speech science, you know, very serious, like speech science. And that's obviously something which it did end up playing a role as you move forward. And were you a musician back then when you were a kid? Are you still a musician?
Yeah, it sounds odd now. I come from a family of musicians, but they were all singers. Uh-huh. So there were musical instruments in the house, but there would always be like, you know, things that you would do to accompany singing. So actually, I think I'm probably, because my father was very musical, but we didn't have any way of sort of recorded music being played in the house. When I was a kid, we didn't have a record player, or I was quite old before we got a cassette player in the car, because music was a live thing. Uh-huh. And he was probably one of the last people, that kind of generation, for whom music was something that you did rather than something you'd go off and listen to. You might go to a performance, but you sort of, you know, the thought of buying it and listening to it that way would just, I just never saw it happen. So yes, I was lucky in that I had a very musical family and there was a lot of music around. And I think that kind of, as I've got more interested in kind of thinking about speech and voices, it does kind of take you back to music, because there is a great musicality to the voice. It's just a, you know, when it's being used for language, has a form that sometimes tricks you away from noticing the musicality. So I have found, I've found a way back to kind of get to think about music sometimes, which, for which I'm grateful.
That's really cool. What kind of music did you, did your family play and listen to? What style of music or styles?
My father had been a singer, and his father was a singer, and they were church singers. You know, my my grandfather was a vicar choral at St. Paul's Cathedral. He's buried in St. Paul's Cathedral. So, you know, if my father took you to see singing, it would be, you know, a Bach Passion or something. It was that, that was the sort of singing that he'd grown up singing. He was a choir boy. And then he'd, his voice wasn't quite good enough to go into it professionally. So he sang a lot, and he'd sung as a child, but he, it wasn't something you could kind of carry on into an adult career. So he'd moved off into sales, basically. But so he was always singing. And that was, it was interesting when my son was born, I found I kind of did the same thing. I would, you know, and you don't realize, I suppose, how much you kind of want to share these things until you find yourself doing it. But it clearly was quite a, you know, it, it's a nice thing to be, you know, to feel, for people to feel comfortable singing, I think is a nice thing in life. So, I'm grateful that I had that experience. I mean, I'm not in any way a good singer, but I enjoy it and I take pleasure in it. And it's nice to be able to listen to other stuff, but also to get to do it yourself.
Yeah, we like to sing in our family too. And but in that respect, I'm different. My parents would never sing. I don't think I've, well, my mum sings, but I've never, I don't think I've ever heard my dad sing a note.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
He's just not the kind of guy that would, like, you know, sing a note of a song or eat ice cream in public or anything like that.
There's something so kind of exposing about the singing voice. It's very, and people are genuinely very anxious about it very often, and I completely understand it, because there's something sort of very truthy about it. And actually, pretty much everyone's got a really lovely voice. You know, there's no, very rarely is there something interesting or pleasant about somebody's voice. But people are so worried about it. Like you say, I will sing. Everyone's expecting, okay, then, well, I need Mariah Carey, do it now. You know, and it's fine. Just doing it at all is normally just the fun part.
Yeah, I do agree. Okay, so I do want to talk about some science, but before we quite get into that, I understand that you recently became a commander of the British Empire.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could kind of explain for all of us non-British people, or maybe even for British people, what that is.
I've gone on a steep learning curve learning this myself. So in 1917, the then king, I forget which one, it might have been one of the last Georges, he... there'd always been a system in the British Army for acknowledging valour and bravery and contributions made by people in the army. And they brought out this order of medals for civilians initially to sort of recognise things people had done in the First World War. So it's structured like a military rank. And you have, at the top level, you've got dames. And then you go down a bit and you get to commanders. And then there's officers and then members. And the title is of the British Empire. And it's just, it's as if the British Empire was a military order. That's basically it.
Right.
So it's very nice. It's basically a sort of a national honour. So obviously very delighted to receive it. It has long lost its kind of connotations. No one ever really thinks too much about the fact that it's based on the British Empire and the British Army.
Right.
You know, but people do turn it down for that reason. So I think the reason I got nominated for one was because I did the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures in 2017. And if you look at the list of people who've done Royal Institution Christmas Lectures, quite a lot of them have an MBE or an OBE or a CBE. So someone has to nominate you. And I strongly suspect I was nominated by the Royal Institution, which is very nice of them.
Yeah, that's really nice. I mean, what a great honor that is. Was there like a fun ceremony where you got a medal and that kind of thing?
At some point there will be, because it's all happened under COVID.
Oh,
no. It hasn't happened yet. So, but there's a dress code and everything. You have to wear a hat. I don't know what I'm going to do.
You do have considerable interest in fashion for a neuroscientist. I know this from following you on Twitter.
I have been thinking quite a lot about the hat and trying to how I can make that work in a way that's not sort of too hyacinth bouquet. But it'll be interesting. I mean, who knows when it will happen? But basically, they have an event at the Buckingham Palace, and a royal pins a medal on you. And you get to take your mum and have a nice. Yeah, which I'm greatly looking forward to. Taking my mum to that.
Yeah. Well, I was pretty chuffed when I saw that. I just kind of thought, you know, one of our field is a commander of the British Empire. I just kind of thought that was very cool.
Well, it is very kind of you. And it's a tremendous honor. It really is a tremendous honor. And it does sort of, you know, it's for services to neuroscience. So that's the kind of, it's an acknowledgement for the field as well. But obviously, you know, I was hugely delighted with it.
Yeah, well, you surely have earned it. Let's talk about, I kind of wanted to start with one of your papers that I know very well because I've used it for teaching for a lot of years, and it's your 2000 paper in Brain. And I think this is a good paper to maybe discuss in some depth because I think it kind of sets the stage for a lot of the themes that you've gone further with in your career after that. So I was wondering, can you kind of tell me and tell our listeners about that paper? I guess I'll just kind of leave it to you to structure it how you want to structure it, and I'll ask more questions if I need to.
It sounds really silly now, but when I was and I first got involved in doing functional imaging, there was this problem, which was when some of the first functional imaging studies people did involved playing people's speech or getting them to speak, because we had this, you know, very good idea of what brain areas we should see recruited from neuropsychology. So we would expect to see something representing Wernicke's area and something to do with Broca's area. Definitely would have to be on the left. But when you played someone's, it kind of worked when someone was talking, but when you played someone's speech, you didn't see a left lateralized system. And it was thoroughly and unambiguously bilateral. And because you're always looking at relative patterns of activation with these brain scans, we got very caught up in how that might be influenced by what we were using as our baseline comparison. So obviously, if you use rest as a comparison, well, you could be seeing loads of bilateral activation, because actually most of that is nothing to do with the fact it's speech. It's because you're hearing a sound. So what comparisons should you use? And people tried reversed words and clicks, and there's always some reason, there's some wiggle out where the acoustics could still be explaining these differences. And I was having a conversation with Stuart Rosen, who'd come up to Cambridge, where I was based at the time, to give a seminar. And he was giving a talk with noise vocoded speech and a lot of stuff about noise vocoded speech, which is speech where you basically replace a lot of the fine spectral detail of speech with noise filtered to different bandwidths. So it sounds like a harsh whisper.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you've got this very reduced spectrotemporal profile, but people can very quickly learn to understand it. And I was saying, you know, that would be a really interesting study to do. And he said, yes. And of course, you could use a different baseline. And so I kind of started saying we should do something with noise vocoded speech. And he said, well, you know, and we would talked about this problem with the baselines. And he said, well, I've got an idea for the baseline. And how about using rotated speech? And rotated speech is a technique that was developed by a guy called Barry Blesser in the 1960s, which basically simply involves flipping the spectrum of a sound upside down, like inverting a face. And like inverting a face, it becomes very hard to decode that information. Although you haven't taken anything away, it's now all in the wrong. For the face, it's in the wrong spatial location, and for the sound, it's in the wrong spectrotemporal point, certainly. But a lot of information is preserved. So you tend to preserve the pitch and the pitch variation. And over a very long period of time, particularly if you only ever listen to one person's voice that's been flipped in this way, you can learn to remap it, to understand it, because you haven't taken stuff away.
Right. I'm interrupting from the future to play examples of the stimuli from this study. First, I'll play a spectrally rotated item, and then I'll play the clear speech version of the same item.
The clown had a funny face.
So we ended up with this study where we had two different kinds of speech. We had the speech that is normal, clear, intelligible speech, and noise vocoded speech, which people have had very little experience with, and we've gave them a quick training beforehand so they can understand it, but it doesn't sound like someone talking. You couldn't tell if it was male or female voice. You would have great difficulty. In fact, that goes as far as to say it'd be very, very hard, certainly with our stimuli, to be able to recognize the talker at all. And now for both of them, we would compare them to their rotated baseline. So something that is a flipped version that people can't hear as something that's intelligible, but which technically, and there are ways in which, in fact, this comparison does break down, but certainly as far as we could see in terms of how you represent the information on a spectrogram, there was no huge difference in terms of the acoustics. And when we did this...
Oh, sorry. Can I just, just kind of for clarity for our listeners, can I just kind of summarize what I'm understanding
and
just make sure it's all above board? So you've got regular normal speech. You've got noise vocoded speech, which is fully intelligible, but kind of, as you said, sounds like a harsh whisper. It's got like a lot of the spectral detail taken out. Then you've got the control for normal speech is going to be spectrally rotated speech, where you've kind of flipped the spectrogram upside down on the y-axis. And so it's got all the spectrotemporal complexity of speech, but is completely unintelligible without a great deal of training. And then you also do that reversal of the noise vocoded condition as well. Is that
exactly so? Exactly, and it's a weird design. People used to call them conjunction designs, and it's basically not a. It sounds like one bit of a 2x2 ANOVA, whereas in fact it isn't really, because what you're saying is, well, I'm going to look for brain areas that are activated both in both comparisons of the intelligible over the unintelligible, where you're using the rotated speech as the baseline for the normal speech and the rotated noise vocoded speech as the baseline for the noise vocoded speech.
Yep.
And that was interesting, because when we did that, we did get a very strongly left lateralized response. And interestingly,
sorry, can you for what contrast?
Yeah.
So can you like kind of lay out the key contrast and what you saw for each one?
So this is, if you say, well, we just analyzed it as a conjunction design. So the planned study was to say these two intelligible conditions over their two unintelligible baselines, what areas are commonly activated by both? And this is a PET study, so it's a very crude study. It's not a you've got a limited number of scans for every participant, but the advantage of PET is if there is something there, you will see it. It's either there or it's not there.
Yep.
So when we followed this up with fMRI, you do see a more extended network, but it has the same basic emphasis, which is you see a largely left lateralized response with a strong emphasis in the front end of the left temporal lobe. And this was not what we were expecting at all. So we saw something we were expecting to find, which was that we're seeing something on the left, showing a strongly dominant response on the left, but it wasn't sitting where we thought it should be. And where we thought it would be was where the dominant view in the 80s and 90s of where the core of Wernicke's area. So the idea of the Wernicke's area is the brain area that Carl Wernicke described that is sort of functionally associated. Damage with that area is associated with problems with the reception of speech. There can be other problems as well, but that's the kind of core of Wernicke's area, is that disorder associated with damage to this area is that you have a difficulty understanding speech. And at the time, the clear view in the literature of where that would map onto on the brain was the posterior superior temporal sulcus on the left. So right at the other end of the temporal lobe is where we were expecting to see a leftwards asymmetry. And we didn't see it there anything like as sharply as we did at the front end of the temporal lobe, which was surprising until We were all at a conference in Dusseldorf when the Human Brain Mapping Conference was in Dusseldorf, and there was a paper being given by Joseph Rauschecker. It was a poster talking about streams of information processing in the non-human primate brain applied to the processing of vocalizations. And he was suggesting there was this sort of anterior going stream associated with the recognition of sounds for non-human monkeys from sound, you know, from conspecific vocalizations. And I thought, oh, maybe that's what we're seeing. Maybe just the kind of the direction of flow is what's driving this. We're obviously not seeing the whole language system. We're kind of emphasizing the acoustic end of this, but that is why we're seeing something that runs anteriorly rather than posteriorly. And there's interesting stuff that goes posteriorly, but it didn't show this initial response. So that was the thing that we kind of wrote the paper up around, and sort of arguing that there's, you can see something left lateralized, but actually the dominant element of this is something running forwards, not backwards. And we'd been expecting something to go backwards. And yeah, it's one of those things, you know, one of those things in science where you think, you know, sometimes you do get a result that makes you change your mind because it's not giving you what you thought you were going to get. And so it was an interesting journey. And then that was very, very useful because it then kind of introduced me into thinking more seriously about the value of engaging with these emerging themes about elements of how information is processed in the non-human primate brain. We'd always sort of ignored that in language. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I definitely want to go right into that. I just want to kind of summarize so that, you know, we can communicate this information solely through the absolutely auditory modality.
Yeah.
So just to kind of summarize, like what you found was that the normal speech and the noise vocoded speech would activate left anterior temporal region. Specifically, I think it was in the superior temporal sulcus.
Yep.
And as opposed to the two rotated conditions, which did not. And so that's a contrast of intelligibility. It's kind of like,
yep,
you're just kind of throwing away this whole manipulation of noise vocoding, really, and just kind of comparing intelligible to non-intelligible. And what you found was that it was left anterior temporal, whereas you'd been expecting left posterior temporal.
The thing that was interesting about having the noise vocoded in there was that if you look at the response in the left anterior superior temporal sulcus, it is equivalent for the clear speech and for this very novel sounding noise vocoded speech. So that looked like it didn't care what the voice sounded like.
Yeah, no, it's beyond, it's not caring about the auditory stimulus anymore. It's a higher level response.
And in fact, you could sort of see as you move forward down the temporal lobe, the response to, say, the rotated speech dropping away. And the rotated speech does sound like something talking. And you can sort of see like the system's doing what it can with it. And then in the end, it's just not making it down into this more abstract level when you probably are moving into something that is interfacing with a more abstract representation of linguistic information, potentially.
Right.
Now, the other thing that's true about that is that, and you're correctly calling it this, we talked about intelligibility in the speech because, of course, we don't know what different elements of the information in the speech have contributed to this. And we haven't even tried to. We've just had people listening to sentences. So we know there were words, we know there were sentences, there was syntactic information, there was semantic information, there's phonetic information, you know, that all of that we've just collapsed down into intelligibility. And, you know, subsequent studies have done a really good job of pulling out different elements of how things are getting processed along that pathway. You know, you can see, you know, almost certainly a lot of parallel processing of the information in speech because it's so fast and there's so much of it. And it's obviously connecting with a wider language system as well. But there's, you know, but I'm deliberately just collapsing it all down into intelligibility so we can do this very crude comparison, which is, I think, you know, it's been criticized for that. And I think that's an acceptable criticism. It is a very, very crude comparison.
Well, yeah, sort of. But at the same time, it was kind of, it's a seminal paper because it was the first really great controlled, the first really well controlled study of language comprehension that was kind of really well controlled for auditory relative to the baseline. And I think that's why it's the clearest, was, you know, one of the first studies to show a really clear left lateralized response, right?
Yeah. And I think that's fair. And I think the thing that I have to say full credit to this goes to Stuart Rosen, who's really, he not only had the insight about the bass lines, but also said, you know, you should be using sentences. Because when you hear, before then, we'd always use words. You'd hear, it's like a sequence of people going, apple, table. And actually, you hardly ever hear speech like that. You know, yeah. It's not, like the normal job of the perceptual system is not dealing with these isolated words said with a very strange intonation.
Yeah, and I'm going to edit into the podcast later some of your stimuli, which you sent me many years ago. And it's the one that I remember, it goes like this. It goes, the clown had a funny face.
Yes.
And then there's a spectrally rotated version of it, which goes, and it's kind of amazing that it's, you know, when you see the spectrogram, it like looks almost identical to the normal spectrogram. And yet when you listen to it, it's, you know, absolutely unintelligible.
It has a weird, when I can hear it now, it sounds to me, only for Quentin Summerfield, who was the speaker we were using, when his voice is spectrally rotated, I can understand that. And it sounds to me like someone saying, talking with their jaw really clenched. Very, very odd way of articulating. There's a strong element of that. So there's some cue about what the articulators are doing that you do start to pick up on, and it's obviously wrong because it's not there. You know, it's not what the speaker was doing. It's what the rotation has done.
Yeah, it's funny that you've pointed out that like eventually you can learn to understand rotated speech, because I've listened to a fair bit of it and I've never been able to understand it at all.
there may be an accent thing in there as well, but I have worked with it for, it took years before it started jumping out, but and I do realize you've worked with it as well.
So. Yeah, only a little, but yeah. So you were sort of starting to, before I kind of interrupted you to like clarify basic findings, you were starting to talk about how you realized how important it was going to be to like kind of interpret these findings in humans in the context of what was known from animals and animal models. So do you want to kind of talk a little more about that?
Yeah, for a very long time the people in the sort of neuroscience end of things would look for non-human models for, you know, different phenomena that you're interested in, because it makes, you know, different sorts of studies are possible and different kinds of ways of investigating are possible. And the dominant view in speech and language was that we didn't have any animal models for any feasible animal models for language, because no other animals spoke. And, you know, that seems, that at one level that's true, but it is also true that while other animals don't talk, other animals do still communicate, and you don't have a, you know, what's the best way of phrasing it? I think there's just been a very dominant view, a very human-centric view about what that would mean. But what I was very struck by with Joseph Rauschecker's work and Kars and Hackett's work, looking at the sort of the wiring of the perceptual system in sound processing in non-human primates, was they did relate it to the complexity of the vocalizations that these animals did use. So rather than saying, well, do they speak or not? I say, well, what do they do? They do use vocal information for communication. And you do have to some degree, again, the cutoff is difficult to say, but certainly in primates, you can argue that you have a strong element of a different perceptual organization associated with organization, anatomical organization associated with perception. It's very clearly seen in the visual system. And it's almost certainly there for somatosensory processing. And they were looking at it from the view of auditory processing. So I thought, and I wasn't the only person to think this, but I suddenly saw the value in actually we can learn a lot about like the properties of this system that we're asking questions about by asking in a very crude way, how does the wiring work? You know, we're not the same as other monkeys, but we are still primates. And some of that, it's worked very well in the visual system. So can we, you know, take something from that into what we're doing when we ask questions about auditory processing of communication calls? So that has been very interesting to me. And I think more generally, really, you know, functional imaging techniques like positron emission tomography, which I was using initially, and then functional magnetic resonance imaging, they are anatomical techniques. It does make sense to try and use anatomy to guide your interpretation and to think about what this could mean in terms of how is the system organized.
Yeah, cool. So in some of your work following up from this paper, you did work with Joseph Rauschecker and with Carolyn McGinnigan and others, and you've kind of come up with a number, you've got a number of papers that kind of lay out these models of speech perception. And they all kind of have this, they involve multiple streams of processing. That's an important feature of your models. And, you know, you've kind of got this anterior stream that you've been talking about just now, you know, kind of identifying the, or maybe it's like the auditory equivalent of the what stream. You've talked about a posterior stream that's important more for auditory localization. I'm wondering if you see there as being additional language relevant streams apart from the anteriorly directed one that we've been talking about so far.
Well, I think one of the things that is fairly clear is that in these posterior stream or streams, there's also some sensory motor integration so that you get very clear links between, you know, perception and action seem to have one of the links between those phenomena is occurring via this, via a posterior route. Now, the extent to which that's related to localization of sounds, I think it's possibly not totally different. We don't tend to think of speech production as a spatially organized task, but actually it is. You know, your articulators and the movement of the tongue around the fixed points in your articulators is an incredibly well determined spatial organization of structures. So we don't, you know, we think of it because it's all in one place relative to the rest of the world, but we sort of forget that. But I think that's it's possible there is some similarity of that coding, although we don't know for sure.
Wouldn't sound location and space, I mean, it's a very different space from the space of your articulators, right?
It is, but that's still spatial.
Uh-huh.
So when your voice, actually, you never hear any other sound coming from where your voice comes from. It has a spatial location, and then you're organized, you know, the way that you filter and change that sound by speaking is using, you know, it's like thinking about using visual information to guide your hands. You can think about using auditory information and somatosensory information to guide your articulators, but that guidance is still spatial, as it would be for your hands. That's played out in a spatial configuration.
Right.
Now, you know, but it is possible they're different. You know, it's possible there's a somatosensory pathway, and it's possible there's a spatial localization of sound pathway, because we know that's happening out there. That does happen in that route.
Yeah.
And also, there is something funny that we've never really got to grips with, but there is, if the visual pathways, there are more than two that people talk about that have different sort of, so there is that pathway from visual information up to biological motion areas. So this would be, in terms of auditory processing, something that's kind of going backwards a bit and down,
yes,
towards the back end of the middle temporal gyrus, that I think we quite often see it, but I don't think we always, you know, because it's such a strongly linked to visual biological motion. And I don't think we've always been good about thinking about what that would translate into in sound. But I have, you do see something happening there. And I wonder a lot about what that would mean for, you know, does that translate into something that's to do with language? Is it important in language? I think it could well be very important in language. But it,
Wernicke was no fool, right?
Well, exactly. And he, and in fact, if you go back, well, this is Joseph Rauschenker did this, not me, but if you go back to Wernicke's original paper, he is talking about the superior temporal gyrus.
Absolutely.
Along its length. You know, he wasn't putting a cross at one end and saying it's there. So it is definitely, you know, he was embracing the entirety of the stuff that we've taken apart in more pieces, but he was saying it's all important. And of course, he did, you know, in the bigger picture is, it is all important.
Yeah, no, Wernicke didn't really have the kind of, like, you know, he didn't have the kind of spatial resolution that we have available to us nowadays. I mean, he only had an autopsy on one of his two patients who he originally based his theory on, so.
It's kind of dizzying, actually, when you look at those original pictures and think that you've got so much right from that.
Yeah, his intuitions were pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
So you're kind of open to the idea that there might be like posteriorly directed stream as well that could be relevant for language in some way?
No? I mean, I think it's entirely possible. I think you get so caught up in like minimal arguments about this does this or that does that. I think it is really helpful to sort of take a step back and say, well, in the visual system, there are definitely three. So, you know, what does that mean in the auditory system, or why would it be constrained to three? Maybe there are more. Maybe there's this kind of spatial stuff I'm talking about disambiguates that way. But you do occasionally see it. So in a paper that we never published, I did an analysis. Zarina Agnew did a very interesting analysis of we'd had people listening to sounds. We're trying to reanalyze some data at the moment, see if we can find this again. People listening to sounds, maybe different effectors. So sounds from the mouth, sounds from the hands, sounds from the feet, footsteps. And we had people hearing the sounds and we had people seeing the effectors making the sounds. And actually where we found the clearest spatial mapping of an overlap for the visual input and the auditory input, and it actually mapped out separately through effectors, was running down into that posterior middle temporal gyrus. And it looked almost like a body map. And, you know, that was just one of those things that ended up, it wasn't what we were looking for. We didn't quite have a way of thinking about what it meant, and we've never published it. And as I say, with some data collected by Saloni Krishna at the moment, we're trying to go back in, because there was some funny, one of the reasons why we were a little bit about that was the footsteps were very different from the other noises.
Yeah.
You know, so we were just worried about that. So we've gone in just asking questions about hand and mouth sounds and whether or not there's a tool involved. And that will be one of the areas we look at. So, you know, right. And I think it's so easy with functional imaging as well to think that you design your study to, you know, have a particular contrast in it. But we know that shows you, it's a very, you know, these kinds of baseline-based tasks, for want of a better phrase, do just give you a snapshot of the particular stuff revealed by that design. It doesn't tell you the bigger picture, because if it's something commonly activated, then you won't see it, you know. So I think that's, you know, it's easy to kind of get caught up in what you do see and be a bit blinder to what you haven't seen.
Right, because, I mean, the baseline is so critical, as you kind of mentioned in that first study we were talking about. So what do you think about, I was going to say, you know, there's a lot of studies of audiovisual speech perception that kind of like tend to focus on that posterior superior temporal sulcus as well. So that kind of that, you know, where the auditory and the visual come together is, you know, there's a lot of evidence that that's back there.
And certainly like Lynn Bernstein has argued, that's where you get the visemes, you know, the phonetic representation that you get from the face, that's there. And I think that would be, you know, that sounds entirely plausible, and given the, you know, based on where it is in terms of the brain and where it would sit in terms of the visual and the auditory system being able to speak to each other in an area we know cares about biological motion. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's right. So what do you think about lateralization of speech perception? I know that you've argued against kind of attempts to derive it from acoustic properties of speech. What do you think is the differential roles of the left and right hemispheres in speech perception?
I think we still haven't got a good way of describing it. All we know is for sure is it's not simple. I think it is really interesting that you can drive the right temporal lobe acoustically. It likes longer sounds. It likes sounds that has pitch variation. It likes things that sound like voices. It doesn't care if you understand it or not. There is some evidence that it has a dominant role in processing effective information in sound. So all of those are things you can actually put acoustic labels on. It's not one acoustic label, acoustic labels, but the very rarely do you see something that shows an easily acoustically defined characteristic that drives signal responses, or sorry, drives cortical responses in the left temporal lobe with that same sort of purely acoustic element. So it's like, it's very interesting because it's definitely there. There is an acoustic basis to it, but it's going in the rightwards direction.
Uh-huh.
And I think, I mean, Tim Schallis, a kind of classic cognitive scientist, has always argued that the left side of the brain is the stuff that does, more abstract computational representations. And that's why it has this role in categorization and anything, you know. And of course, one of the very abstract elements of the representation of information in a linguistic system is categorizing stuff into labels and different kinds of information like that. So it could be that. It could be that there is some other way of characterizing, you know, is the left temporal lobe just really, or part of a bigger system that's first very good at sort of dealing with meaning information in that more abstract way. You know, that there are a lot of possibilities.
Uh-huh.
I don't think, or even down to, you could say, well, do you know what? It's speech production that's left lateralized and everything else gets pulled over as a result of that.
Right.
You know, and then why is speech production left lateralized? Well, maybe because attention systems are lateralized as well. You know, when you get to a higher level, you do find other things than speech are lateralized in this way. So there's, you know, there is some, you know, I wouldn't want to, I don't think we know. We've done, you know, people have come up with great ideas and none of them really have stood any of the, you know, none of the simpler stuff has worked, because why would it be, I guess. But I think I wouldn't want to rule anything out, because I think we still don't absolutely know.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like, you know, you've kind of, yeah, you think we're pretty early on and we don't understand too much about that yet.
I think because we've asked the wrong questions often by focusing in so much on speech and not all the other information that's there when you hear a voice.
Yeah. So you've really emphasized in your work that speech is social and that there's a lot of information being conveyed apart from linguistic information. You think that's been underemphasized in language neuroscience research?
Well, I think, I mean, I can see why, because there are so many applied things for which you would want to know how speech works, you know, speech synthesis, clinical problems, speech recognition systems. There's a great history of focusing in on that level because, you know, if someone has an aphasic stroke, well, that is what they will complain about. You know, they can, a stroke that robs you of your ability to enjoy music frequently can be silent, you know.
Yep.
But also, so that, I mean, I totally understand that. And it's what a lot of our, you know, that's what Wernicke and Broca were interested in. They were interested in the faculty of language. And that's what we meant by language. But I think that, for example, we know that the speech information, the linguistic information in speech is not entirely independent of all the other information in there. So, for example, if you know a talker, it will be easier for you to understand that talker.
Uh-huh.
If you are confronted with a novel speaker who has an idiosyncratic way of producing certain phonemes, so in British English, it's not particularly unusual to meet people who say like a ruh sound slightly differently. So say something like wed wobbin rather than red robin.
Uh-huh.
People immediately adapt to that just for that speaker. They don't remap what a ruh sound is for anybody else.
Right.
So you are doing a very talker-specific adaptation. And if you don't speak a language, people can find it very hard to tell talkers apart.
Right.
So although we can treat them as separate, in fact, the more you look at how they're used, the more you start to realize that whatever's happening, it is really interacting. And again, the techniques we use for looking at this, for identifying these networks, are not good for showing us where stuff comes together.
Right.
In a higher order way. But actually, I suspect that's really kind of baked in. So even if it is lateralized earlier on in the system, that's not telling you the end of the story. That's telling you something about how that information is getting pulled out, maybe for lots of different reasons, before it's all being pulled back together. And it must be having influences right back down. If it is easy for you to understand a speaker when you know them, that does imply that that must be having kind of backwards effects into the perceptual system.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So they're a lot more integrated and it's not easy to kind of study them by separating them out in the way that we usually force ourselves to.
And I, you know, I'm a big fan of separating things out. I will happily defend everything we've ever done that did this.
Yeah.
But you only get to so far by looking at it that way. So these kind of network approaches that let it, well, you know, as the field is developed and we're no longer constrained to just like a, I mean, when did you last see a conjunction design? Which felt very sophisticated in the 90s, I can tell you. But, you know, things, it's starting to actually ask questions about how these much more complex interactions that are at the heart of how we're normally using speech when we hear it and when we talk to people, how that's actually reflecting the two, you know, the left and right systems interacting and how that's influencing stuff all the way back down. You know, that's going to be the next thing that would be really, really interesting to know about. Where does it happen? Does it happen in any one place? Is it the whole system it's happening in?
Yeah, cool. So over the last few years, you've been working a lot on laughter.
Yes.
I don't know much about that. I'd like to learn more. Do you think you'd be able to tell me a bit about, I noticed there was a recent study in Current Biology that you guys published that showed that laughter can influence how funny we find humor to be. Can you tell us about that study?
Yes. So this was, we've done quite a lot of work with laughter, which I never set out to study laughter. It's just because from the 90s onwards, I've always had like a sort of side game of looking at emotional vocalizations, because there's most of the work in emotion recognition systems is with faces. And I had colleagues who needed another modality, so I started helping them with that. And then, so I ended up, and, you know, that's how I came to laughter. I never set out to look at laughter. And it's a very interesting behaviour because it's a very social emotion. You only really find it in social interactions. It's highly behaviourally contagious. And we were, a lot of our studies with laughter, we play people a laugh and then we ask some questions about it. You know, how real do you think that laugh was? How much do you want to join in with that laugh? Uh-huh. And my PhD student, Ceci Kai, who's the first author on the paper, she got a bit worried about these like direct questions because they are a bit odd. And particularly if you want to go into like a group of people, say, with autism, what does it mean to say, is that laughter real or not? And what, you know, does it even mean what we think it means to people?
Yep.
So we wanted an indirect test of how people hear laughter. And she had the idea of adding the laughter onto jokes. And the question is, how funny is the joke?
Uh-huh.
And people are comfortable telling you how funny they think jokes are. I think we have a reasonably comfortable that people understand what you mean if you say, how funny did you find that? Was it a little bit funny? Not a lot funny? Some not at all funny? So we recorded a set of terrible jokes, which we deliberately chose terrible jokes so that they could be made funnier. And then we edited the laughter onto the end. And we got people to rate the different group of people to rate the jokes again. So we've got the jokes rated with no laughter. And then we have them rated when we've added laughter onto the end. And there's nothing, it doesn't sound like, you know, it doesn't sound like you're hearing a joke told to a theatre or anything like that. It sounds highly artificial. And we just, it's the same question, how funny is the joke? And what we find is adding any laugh to a joke makes the joke seem funnier. And the more spontaneous the laughter, the funnier it makes the joke. So this was really, it worked for what Ceci wanted, which is it does seem to give you a signal that people are sensitive to the laughter without asking them about the laughter. But it also was interesting because it suggests that you can't ignore laughter, even when you're thinking about something that's apparently just about the joke itself. If someone else is laughing, it's a very strong influence on your perception of the humour. So maybe that's still contagion. Maybe it's a sort of social approval. We don't know, but it was very interesting.
That's so cool. Do you think it would be possible for me to make my own jokes funnier by laughing at them?
Definitely. And in fact, if you look at comedians, they quite often do that. I was talking to a comedian, she's from the US, called Abigail Ashimom. She works mostly in the UK. And I was telling her about this result. And she said that she, and I've seen other comedians do this, she said that she had a couple of jokes that are really quite dark. And if she smiles when she tells them, the audience are much more likely to laugh. Uh-huh. And I know he's nobody's favourite comedian at the moment, but Louis C.K., I noticed when he tells particularly dark material, he quite often like properly laughs afterwards. He's kind of telling the audience it's okay and it's funny, you know. So it is actually lots of comedians do some variety of this, but just like a little, this is so funny, it's made me laugh kind of
air. Right. Yeah.
Really add it. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember like Billy Connolly always laughing at his own jokes.
Yes.
When they got to a certain level of funniness, and it would just, the ones that he like would burst at, like that he seemed that he couldn't contain himself. Those are the ones which I also remember from his old, like I used to have like this Billy Connolly tape that I would listen to like just every single night and just like crack myself up when I was probably about 13 or something.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
But it's also true because what he would do, he would laugh on the way to getting to the punchline. Like, I know this is making me laugh. You are going to love it. And yeah, it's a fantastic feeling.
It works so well. It's just it's great. So can you tell me, what are your current projects that you're most excited about that you're working on right now?
Well, trying to get funding, like we all are at the moment.
That's not exciting. That's not exciting at all.
Boring. So recently I've been working with my former PhD student, Carl Jasmine, and a colleague in Portugal, Cesar Lima, trying to get a bit more computational about what we think might be happening in these auditory streams of processing. And that's a journey, and I found that engaging and interesting. And I think, you know, when we get out of the current lockdown and we can actually, no one's been able to really collect data in the UK for nearly a year now, so it's hard. But when we get back to it, actually trying to test these networks out in a way that's asking questions about like the properties of processing rather than how is this speech processed is something I'm looking forward to. And I'm also getting very interested in trying to find ways of actually characterizing the neural systems involved in the social use of language. So what we're doing right now, you know, talking to each other, aligning our voices, but also, again, you know, we've always, I say we, but people like me have always studied here is the perception of speech, here is the production of speech. And that's not how it works in the wild. And also, you know, people, I made arguments like you that, well, you know, the you've got this, there's a very clear role for, you can think of motor cortex as perceptual cortex because it has this strong involvement in, it responds to the perception of things out there, not visual, auditory. It's got this information coming in, and trying to sort of think about the fact that if you think of the job of the brain as being perception, you're either perceiving the stuff that's out there or the stuff that you're doing, and how does that get implemented in conversation? How does it actually work?
Right.
That's, I mean, it's hard to look at, but that's one of the things I'm really, really keen on finding out more about. And we're getting better at doing, like, you know, like using different techniques for doing hyperscanning where you could scan two people in a conversation and that kind of thing.
Oh,
I'm
that's
really
cool.
Interested in that. Yeah. And that's sort of the dynamics of that.
Yeah. So really just kind of getting into conversation and building, you know, the social aspect that has been understudied and the,
If there are journals about social neuroscience and they never include communication.
Well, I think that's kind
of language.
That's, I think that's our fault. So, I mean, we should take responsibility for it, right? The language neuroscience field should say, okay, that's going to be we need to like be on that.
I think so. And it's like,
the social people are not going to.
No.
Because language is really daunting to people that are not language people, you know, that's just like a huge black box. And linguists are so intimidating, like, to people who are not linguists. So
I did a study on syntax with one of my colleagues, Zarina Agnew, and our linguist colleague, Hans van der Koot, and it was on some sort of syntactic movement. And it was one of those things where when I was talking to him, I knew what we'd done. And as soon as he stopped talking, it was gone. I was like, I had something to do with syntax. The paper on syntax, there's a response to syntax. The life of me, with a gun trained on me, I could not tell you actually what we'd done. And it is, you know, that's what I thought language was before I started working with speech. I thought you were always drawing tree diagrams and looking at sort of theta movement and things like that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, I found with my first episode of the podcast, a lot of students listened to it. So I was kind of wondering what advice would you give to a young scientist who's interested in language and the brain? Like, what do you think they should be doing right now?
My general advice would be, good call. It's a fascinating area. Language takes you in so many directions. It takes you to motor control. It takes you to auditory processing. It takes you to the social world. It is the dominant mode for social interactions around the world. When we talk about social networks, we mean the people we talk to. So it has this incredible power. It's as a topic to study, you've got so many different ways you can go into this and so much we still don't know. So I think it's a fantastically exciting area. And I wouldn't be afraid to follow your interests. You know, it is entirely valuable and valid to read a paper and think, well, I wonder this. I'd like to know more about that. Ask those questions. My colleague John Duncan in Cambridge always makes this point that people tend to get interested in anything you give them to study because humans are good at that. And that is what happened with me in my PhD. I did not want to study speech in that way. And then I actually loved it. But also, you know, so don't turn your nose up at stuff you end up having to do. You'll still learn something from that. But also do feel free to, you know, kind of make a note of stuff that you think is interesting. And, you know, one of the joys of science is the pleasure of finding things out and getting to ask questions. So, you know, it's always interesting. But it's even more interesting if it's something that really kind of captures your interest. You want to know more about that. What will we find when we do this? Don't shy away from that.
Cool. And I have one last question, which is, but it's maybe a bit of a silly question for you because you actually have some side gigs. but my question is, like, do you have any fantasy careers besides being a cognitive neuroscientist? Or what would you be if you weren't a cognitive neuroscientist?
Well, I think practically, if I hadn't gone into academia, by the time I was born, my wider family was largely people working in carpeting. And that's probably either working in, you know, the sort of sales or management side of carpets or some other trade. Like my father was really keen for me to go into a non-existent company anymore called ICI, which would mean, of course, I wouldn't be working. Britain doesn't have a sort of manufacturing sector any longer. But that was what, you know, that's what my grandparents did on my mother's side. That's how my parents met. That's, you know, my father gone off to work for his uncle. So it's a big family of carpet people.
Okay, that's not the answer I was expecting at all.
But probably would have been that. I don't know if my heart would have been lying in that, but that's you know, like that's what family interests would take me into. I've been lucky enough in because of academia, not because I ever set out to do it, thinking I'd be good at it. I was to get into doing stand-up comedy, and I love doing that. That is an absolute joy. I would recommend it to anybody, particularly if you're thinking I could never do that. You definitely should do that because you will learn so much, and it's an absolute wild ride. And you just it is like the most in at the deep end experience in rebooting confidence and a sort of sense of, if you know, if I can do that, I can do anything.
Yeah.
So I would definitely recommend that.
Do you have some of your stuff up online? Your stand-up?
I do. It's not particularly. People are not fooled, you know.
Okay, well, can you send me the link to your best online stand-up so that I can put it in the show notes and people follow up with you?
There's one of me doing stand-up comedy at the Royal Institution, which is not the natural home for laughter. But there's definitely some of it out there. But I think that, you know, it's such a, as scientists, we actually do really interesting jobs and we have interesting stuff to talk about. So in fact, and we're used to giving talks. And that already puts you ahead of a lot of people who want to try this kind of stuff out. You already have a lot of the skills to your disposal. So I would definitely... Absolute advice to anybody, not just young scientists, but really do consider giving it a go, because I learned so much. And I did it for the first time when I was in my mid-40s, and it sort of changed everything for me. So I wouldn't have got the CBE if I hadn't done the stand-up comedy, because that's what got me a TED Talk, and that's what got me the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures, and that's what got me this, you know, it's...
Connecting to a wider audience.
I owe that. Yeah, exactly. It's given me a lot of opportunities. And yeah, it's been a... You know, a much more productive exercise than I would have imagined. I thought it was something I'd try once and then, you know, well, that's it, did that, never going back there. But in fact, it wasn't. It led to lots of other stuff, and it has been really useful.
That's so cool. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I think our listeners are going to really enjoy listening to everything that you had to say.
No problem at all. And what a good idea in the podcast. Good luck with this. And thank you very much for inviting me. It's been really enjoyable talking with you, and lovely seeing you again.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
You take care. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, that's it for this episode. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app. And if you have time, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Sophie's work, I've put some relevant links and notes on the podcast website, which is langneurosci.org/podcast. I'd be grateful for any feedback. You can reach me at smwilsonau@gmail.com or smwilsonau on Twitter. Okay, thanks for listening, and see you again soon for episode 3. Bye for now.